This episode is a very special live edition of the Danko Jones podcast because there's a book on us. Someone wrote a book on us. Stuart Berman wrote a book on us. It's called Too Much Trouble, and it's out on ECW Press. Stuart wrote the Broken Social Scene book called This Book is Broken, and he writes for The Grid, Pitchfork, and has contributed to Spin, CMJ, and other esteemed magazines. He'll pop up when you least expect it, like the voice on the other end of the Frank Black phone interview in the Pixies movie Loud, Quiet, Loud. We've been friends for a long time, and to be honest, I think the time was right for someone to write a book on our band. If the average lifespan for a band is 7 years, whether people realize it or not, we've been around for almost 17 years. That's 2.5 lifespans for a band. In that time, a lot has happened. But when rock and roll becomes the backdrop to what's happened, it usually makes for a good read. Stuart spent almost 1.5 years interviewing people, hunting people down for interviews, even hopping on tour with us at one point to, quote-unquote, soak up the vibe, if you will, all to carve out what was staring us in the face all this time, the story of our band. Done in the oral history style like Legs McNeil's Please Kill Me or The Other Hollywood, over 70 people were interviewed, and they spanned the breadth of our career, from Ian Savonius, Jello Biafra, and Peaches, to Lemmy, Dizzy Reed, and Marty Friedman. Now that it's done, I can say that I'm very, very happy and proud about the book. I think Stuart did a remarkable job, and the people at ECW Press knocked it out of the park. Biographies are usually done at the end of a band's career, but I feel this is just a new beginning for us, as far as I see it. When you've been around the music game for as long as we have, but stayed the course at a consistent B level, never blowing up, but never going away, chances are your story will get lost in the breeze. This book captures and codifies our story for people who were into us, say, 15 years ago, but perhaps moved on, and for people who just got into us 3 years ago. Now, is there a part two book? Hopefully. I mean, I wouldn't bet against us because there are no plans to slow down anytime soon. After all, we just put out a new record last week called Rock and Roll is Black and Blue. Now, I don't mean to push product on this podcast. I never plugged anything the band did on the radio show that I used to do. But I really got to say, it's a great read, so please pick it up if you can. To commemorate the book's release on October 4th of this year, 2012, Stuart, JC, and I held an open discussion about Too Much Trouble at a venue called The Supermarket in Toronto. It was a fun evening hosted by CBC Music's Vish Khanna with Nick and Jay from Biblical and Julian from the Colaheads, doing a karaoke set afterwards of our band songs. And I think the three guys did a bang-up job. And the boys from Biblical and Julian from the Colaheads really knocked it out of the park, especially Julian on guitar. He was under the gun. I was watching him. And all three guys did a great job. So thanks, guys, for that as well. Before Vish and I even met, going back to Vish Khanna, we had already gotten into a bit of a Twitter battle, which when you hear this podcast episode is quite understandable. And at this point, I don't think we can even carry on a conversation without the two of us trying to burn one another. So I reluctantly gave up my post as podcast host for this special live taping. In the end, I think Vish did a great job and talks are in the works to do more nights like this one. I must say that the audio is what it is due to the venue and my technical inability to work the soundboard to hook up the mics, but it is a testament to Blue Mic microphones because all I did that night was set up one Yeti Blue Mic in front of the PA, and I think it captured the very, very live atmosphere of this podcast. You can hear the general mulling of the crowd as more people showed up throughout the night and kind of wandered in and out of both rooms because both rooms meaning the venue where we held the discussion and the general bar slash restaurant area were open. The doors weren't closed for this night. So you can kind of hear the people mulling about, you know, later on. But I still think it's quite an enjoyable listen. So here we go. A very special live edition of the official Danko Jones podcast. And it starts now.
special live edition of the Danko Jones podcast. My name is Peach Connor. We're coming to you from the supermarket in Kensington Market in Toronto, Ontario. We're here to celebrate the launch of a great new book called Too Much Trouble, A Very Oral History of Danko Jones. Now, before we get into the program, I do want to mention a couple of things. We have some sponsors to thank. Blue Mic Microphones and Skull Candy Headphones. If you are in the market for using microphones and headphones, may I suggest that combination? They seem like good people. How about a hand for our sponsors? Also, we wouldn't be here tonight if it wasn't for a wonderful press from Canada called ECW Press, who published this book. You can learn more about them at ecwpress.com. For those of you listening, that's where you can pick up the book. That's one area. You can also bother your local book retailers. And for those of you in the room, it's available tonight for sale for the special low price of $25. And it's a great read. So there you go. ECW Press, everybody. How about that? My name's Vish Khanna, as I said earlier. I'm from Guelph, Ontario. It's nice to be here, and I'm thrilled to introduce our guests tonight. One of them is a very respected writer. He writes for The Grid in Toronto, also Pitchfork. He's also written a book called This Book is Broken, about a broken social scene, and he fronts a great band called The Two Koreas. The other guy, actually there's two other guys, the other two guys play in a band that you're all very familiar with, I'm sure, by now. One of them is a raconteur. He has this podcast. He does all sorts of different things. It's just too much to really mention right here. I'm just going to bring him on stage. Should I just do that? Are you guys ready? Please welcome Stuart Berman, JC, and Danko Jones. Have a seat, guys.
Thank you, Mitch.
Nice to have you here. Yes. Nice to see you. This is great. Thanks for having me on your podcast, Danko.
No problem. Thank you.
Are you okay with me taking it over?
Like, yes, I'm totally fine.
It's kind of fun, right? It's to have someone else in the driver's seat.
Not very comfortable about it, but it's cool. We'll do it for an hour.
I will do what I can to drive it well, if I might say. Now, everyone's gathered here. It's great to see you all here. Now, you two, before we get into the book, Stuart and Danko and JC, you all have an interesting history together in terms of how you know each other now, but you kind of encountered each other in kind of an interesting way. Can you maybe talk a little bit about, Stuart, how you first encountered who we all know now as Danko Jones?
I first knew Danko as a sexy voice on the Sunday night on the radio on CHRY.
Was it Sunday night?
Yeah.
7 yes, from 11 a.m. to 2 a.m.
11 to 2
he 11 was a show called The Seminal Blowed. Very tastefully named show, Seminal Load.
Seminal Load.
Don't know what he could be referring to there.
I don't understand.
And you know, when I was in high school, I would just like listen to radio at night, kind of flip through these channels. I had a remote control that allowed me to flip through radio stations, much like television. So I would go.
I'm familiar with TV.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful invention.
Beautiful. How about a hand for media, everyone? Sorry.
So I would scan.
We'll edit that out.
I would scan through like CKLN, which is 88.1, CIUT 89.5, CBC Radio had Radio Waves on 94.1, and then York CHRY was 105.5. Yeah. So this show Seminal Load, I would listen to you every Sunday night, and there was this very mellow dude co-hosting it, and I learned a lot of what would become my favorite bands throughout the 90s. I was introduced through this show.
To the show.
Love.
Interesting.
And then a few years later, you know, everyone was talking about this band Danko Jones in Toronto, and you know, I'd see him, and it's like, you know, crazy dude on stage working his mojo, and then it wasn't until like around 98, 99 that I actually put two and two together that this, you know, man with the dulcet tone in his voice was the same guy.
You're really kissing his ass up here. I noticed that. Interesting. What do you want from this man?
Just some royalties.
JC, were you a fan? Did you hear Danko's college radio show at all?
Yeah, I used to hang out up there quite often on Sundays. Was it 11 to 2?
Yeah, 11 to 2.
11 to 2. Sunday nights. Now, this book is multifaceted. It's not just a profile of Danko Jones. puts a profile of Toronto and the music industry in Canada as well. This is something you did in your Broken Social Scene book as well, where you have this kernel of a thing, and then there's these tentacles that go every which direction, and it's really fascinating. But how did you come to realize that there was this kind of story about Danko Jones?
Well, it's funny. Like, Danko approached me after the Broken Social Scene book came out, and he asked me, you know, why don't you do a book about us? And
of course he did. Why wouldn't you say that? Why don't you write a book about me? I say that to people all the time. I am super fascinated. Is that what you did? Is that you just went up to him?
That's exactly what I did.
You've got gall.
See, the lesson here is you ask for something, you get it.
I am going to talk to you after this.
Yes.
I have an idea for a book.
This is going to be the first chapter right here. There I was on stage. And admittedly, at the time, it took a few conversations for me to sort of cotton on to the idea, because I see Danko Jones as one of those bands that's like super consistent, and they just, you know, they do what they do and have found success doing that. But consistency isn't exactly, you know, the subject of great drama or great narrative. So I had to, you know, really take a step back and look at their entire evolution and realize that, you know, and after watching the presidential debates last night, I'm seeing everything in like squiggly lines and stuff. But you know, if you see their career as sort of this like, you know, consistent trajectory, you know, when you look closely, you see there's actually been a lot of peaks and valleys along the way. And, you know, their story is really unique in the sense of, you know, what they've gone through, both on an indie level and a sort of more overground level. You know, really is unlike a lot of any band that I know of. You know, and the fact that, you know, they found such great success overseas, but, you know, don't receive the same love from their hometown is really, you know, a puzzling question.
Yeah.
Especially because this was a band that in the late 90s, when I first, you know, got into them, they were the talk of the town. They were the sort of hyped, cool indie buzz band. And then, you know, that sort of dissipated, but at the same time, all this interest developed overseas, and, you know, they kind of live this parallel life that doesn't really make sense.
Right. There's a disparity between what they were and what they are, and within that trajectory, a whole bunch of other kinds of disparities.
And they're a band that was sort of in the middle, a lot of sort of sea changes, both on in an indie level and a larger music industry level.
Right.
You know, so there's just a lot of different narratives, both within the band. You know, they've had a lot of, you know, personnel changes, and some amicable, some less so. You know, so there's
are there any drummers here tonight, by the way? Because there might be a gig for you. I'm just putting that out.
Yeah, there's one guy, but he defriended me on Facebook.
Jay?
He's going to be playing later.
You know, I tried to add you as a friend on Facebook yesterday, and I got a curious response via direct message.
You're on Facebook?
You don't want me to talk about...
No, it's cool. What happened? I sent you a form letter, like I do
was
everybody
it,
who tries to friend
with us. Was it you, though? I didn't understand.
Yeah, it was me.
And it was just basically like, you didn't have time to be my friend right now.
I sent everybody who's friend requests me a long letter basically stating how I don't have any time to friend to accept them because I'm really busy.
Right. That's,
one can never be too cautious in this age.
No, absolutely.
I have several of them, and then I'll just... Like in 2 weeks, you'll get. I shouldn't tell you this right now, but in 2 weeks, you'll get another. You'll get another letter going. You're in line. Keep
considering you.
Seriously, just hold on, hold on.
But I responded to your.
And then you get. Then finally, when you get added, it's everything's in capital letters.
Jay Anderson, is that why you defriended Danko Jones on Facebook? He doesn't want to talk about it. See how traumatized he is by this?
Well, I wanted at one point to get more friend requests than friends. So I would mail people and go, hey, be my friend, I'm on Facebook now. Then they'd friend request me, and then bam, with the forum.
Nice. This actually, your persona, if you will, and maybe J.C. Stewart, you can shed some light on this, it does seem to be always pushing against something. And I'm not trying to psychoanalyze you here. I have no degree. But I feel like this is stemming from something, you know, from when you were a kid, a formative time.
Well, Richard Switzer, who's in the crowd tonight, is an old friend of the band and put out one of their EPs. He has a good quote in the book, which basically puts forth the theory that as a child you weren't allowed to play road hockey with the kids in the neighborhood. that results in a lot of pent-up aggression.
That's like fast-forward to chapter 4 or something. Yes, this is true.
So that's true. So there's some element to that. JC,
yes.
do you feel like Danko Jones has a gigantic chip on his shoulder?
I think he entertains himself in a good way. And, just the form letter there.
Right, I have.
You're getting more, by the way.
I am.
Yeah, I'm gonna make you wait longer than usual. Do that.
Okay. I like how you think I really want to be your friend on Facebook. I don't care, really. It's fine by me.
Don't do it.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
I don't mean to pull a Nardwar, but I have something to show you, and I want to know if you can tell me what these things might mean to you, and maybe tell people what they
like
are.
They look like 7-inch records.
This is the Allied recording of Flagcam's 7-inch, the first one, Allied. This is the Rob Zine cover of the double 7-inch Bully My Pushy. And this is the Twilight Pink Hog Bottom. You didn't bring the one that I actually helped put out as well.
I'm sorry, I don't have. I brought
the Duchess Barzula one.
I brought. You want to look at these, Stuart? You can hold them.
Good glimpse.
No, okay, good.
Where are you going with this?
Well, I bring up Flight Camp because they're one of my favorite bands, and they were a huge influence on you. And you got to a point where, much like the film Rockstar, you ended up playing with someone from one of your favorite bands.
Yes, and that's happening today, too, because Adam Willard's in our band. He was in Rocket from the Crypt for 10 years.
Right.
And when we first started, when Stuart first started the interviews with us, it's something I've said to many people many times before, and this is back in 2010. I said the only thing I wanted to do with this band initially was tour with Rocket from the Crypt and record with Doug Easley, who did all those Blues Explosion jukebox 7-inches, which I love, and that's been compiled on In the Red. And Larry Hardy runs In the Red, said he was going to put out our album, never did, forgot that he said that to me,
A lot of resentment coming through all of a sudden.
This is going to happen.
This is not the place for venting. From you.
Okay. Adam's in our band now. So when Don Pyle put out his Trouble in the Camera Club book by ECW.
Spontaneous applause for Don Pyle, a hero in Toronto's music scene. Also a shadowy man on a shadowy planet.
And we've also had a Facebook feud through Stuart.
I'm in the middle of a lot of Facebook feuds.
And I'm totally cool with Don, but apparently he's not with me.
Right. Okay, so where are we going with this? My point...
I have no idea. No, at the book launch, much like this, this was in 2011, I told Stuart that Adam Willard was going to join our band. And so that, to me, was... I love Flight Camp, and Gavin is a machine on drums, as everybody knows, or most people do. And that was great for them. This is a band that influenced the start of our band. When they came out at Lee's Palace in 95 on Scream Dracula Scream, I was in the front row, and they started with us, like a real obscure song, and
you're talking about Rocket from the Crypt now.
Rocket from the Crypt.
Yeah.
That is a bigger deal to me. So having Adam in the band is like, it's just real circle.
I only brought it up because I think it's also interesting that you started out in this hardcore punk vein. Like, these were the people that you were really looking up to. At some point, and within that, you were kind of aspiring to be on labels like Touch and Go, and who else?
Well, Touch and Go was the ultimate to me. Because it had every band that I loved. The Buttholes, Jesus Lizard, Mule,
Shellac,
Tar, John Boy, like with Quarter Stick, like it was Girls Against Boys. It was amazing,
right?
And so, we were on our way. Stuart. He's friends with a lot of people. He's never really burned too many bridges. So he was able to get old band members' trust, people we didn't like, and didn't like us, he was able to kind of at least procure a quote, like Sunset Rubdown has a quote in there.
Well, their publicist has a quote.
Right. Yeah. At least he was able to get that. I implored Stuart to, you know, implored them, like, just speak openly and honestly because nothing will be censored. So it is actually, it was so true that it got me pissed off at times when I'd read some of these quotes. And there was a point, right, where I read it, he gave me a rough draft, and I just said, oh, come on, please let me answer some of these quotes, because you just can't. Well, you can't be an open target.
For those folks who haven't yet read the book, there is quite a bit of back and forth. Mm-hmm. Stuart does this very artfully. There's like a fairly loaded statement. Maybe you respond, then the other person responds. There does seem to be some back and forth.
Yeah, we've really, over the years as band members have left, we've really kind of taken the high road and not talked shit about them in interviews and stuff, simply because they're not here to defend themselves. I mean, but I'm totally an open book when it comes to them. I got the emails to prove it, man. Certain members begging to come back here into our band. And then in front of an audience or in front of people just saying, ah, fuck them, fuck. You know, I have the email.
Are you allowed to swear on your podcast?
Yes. Yeah, you totally can.
I'm from CBC. We can't say those things.
For job security.
Get it all out of your system now.
I don't,
just do it.
I don't think I can. I think
that's why you work for them, man.
They called them Mother Corp for a reason.
I can just see the Toronto Sun headline. Taxpayer dollars funding profane.
The point of all of this flight camp, we brought up Gavin Brown, who used to be in the band. My point is there's been this interesting trajectory where you were within that indie rock, whatever, those circles. Those are the things you aspired to. I think early on for the band, they were your aspirations. They seem relatively modest now. But you were kind of rejected by that, by Touch and Go in particular.
Well, it's also worth remembering that in the late 90s, it was really hard for a Toronto indie band or a Canadian indie band to make connections across the border. Canada was very isolated from, you know, what was happening in the U.S. Like, in the U.S., you had this whole infrastructure of labels like Matador and Touch and Go that were turning, you know, bands like the Blues Explosion and Pavement into, you know, semi-popular groups that could fill, you know, 1,000, 2,000 seat venues, whereas in Canada, you didn't really have that infrastructure. You know, a band could sell out Lee's Palace, but there wasn't really anywhere to go from there.
So the
unique thing about Danko Jones in the beginning was they had all these U.S. connections to bands like Blonde Redhead and The Makeup and the New Bomb Turks, who were popular club acts at the time. And, you know, instead of sort of busting their ass locally, they just went straight to New York with The Makeup and, you know, built followings across the border, which was a very unique thing at the time. Now it's so much easier because the internet has, you know, broken down a lot of those barriers.
And in the book, it's really remarkable. I can't think of any other Canadian bands. There probably were, but I can't think of any other bands that were kind of in my, you know, in my independent community that did that. And JC and Danko, can you maybe illuminate a bit about what Stuart's saying? How did you manage to do that? How did you manage to get these bands that you admired so much to bring you down to the States and then develop this sort of network?
With the New Bomb Turks, that was the first show that we played in Toronto. We played with them and they loved the band, so we were able just to go down to Columbus and play shows with them. With The Makeup, we drove down to, I think it was Rogers, Buffalo, to see their show, and we gave them, like back then we had a cassette, so we just gave them a cassette and we kept in touch. And then with via Makeup, we met Blonde Redhead. And then we did dates with them, and so we just kind of made connections there. So
it was like networking and networking. It was before the internet, but it was faster for us back then. And that's really something that nobody, all these like rock, indie rock pundit come latelys who've joined the scene, have no idea. Sorry, guys, if you're consider yourself one of those.
Does anyone consider themselves a Johnny Come Lightly indie rock pundit? I'd like to see your business card. That must be really long.
Sorry. I'm trying not to get into a rant with this book because I can't. I do it at home.
But anyways, you're just by yourself ranting?
Yes.
That must be sad and terrible.
Or as he calls it, practice.
Practice.
It's called the podcast, right?
It's called the podcast.
That's what the podcast really is.
Yes. And that's a chapter, and that's one of the reasons why we wanted to do this book, is because there's people who only know of our band from like 2003 onwards or 2009 onwards. In Europe, some of the crowds that we look out into, they're really young now. They don't know that there's this whole thing, this whole chapter or couple of chapters of our life as a band that encompasses all these kinds of people. Mm. Which is, you know, yeah, it's for me as a fan, and I think he's a great, he's treated us really nicely, but like the Nickelback tour with Chad was a totally different chapter than like the tour with Blonde Redhead. So, you know, like, yeah. I mean, there's some people.
We like to slot bands into, you know, certain corners and certain scenes and genres, and this is a band that, you know, when you look at the spread of people who participated in this book, it's like real strange mix of characters.
Remind me to come back to that. Okay. I want to talk about that. But I do think what you're talking about is really fascinating, because I think so many bands end up discouraged with these identity crises because they don't know where they belong. Like, they're doing something kind of unique. It crosses over into mainstream sort of realms, but they come from independent music, and they can't get over it. You guys at some point just said, oh, this is going to be fun. Fuck it. And basically...
It's
applied to my child, by the way.
I think we took our slings from people in the book, from like Gavin and a couple other people, and it was us being too idealistic in the beginning. We were too idealistic, and to be honest with you, they were right to a certain extent. It became a burden. Really, it became a burden.
Wait, like, what are you saying? What was a burden?
Like, just trying to uphold, like, the ideals of the punk rock, the invisible punk rock police.
The indie orthodoxy.
Yeah. And I just, both of us just got tired of it. And we just went with whatever's going to be the most fun.
If people are closing doors in your face, why would you continue to try to make them like you?
Well, that's just it.
Yeah.
That was part of it.
And you knew your music also maybe didn't fit. Like, you decided, I think, from what I understand from Stuart's book, you just decided that stylistically that isn't even this kind of sound you were interested in, sort of indie rock at the time. You were more interested in hard rock and metal and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, we came out of the 90s underground garage scene, like the Gorries and the Oblivions and the Headcoats and the Makers and, you know, the Smugglers to a certain degree. And that, like Stuart wrote in the book, that fashion sound changed.
One of the most memorable quotes to me was, I didn't even realize there was still a band. That's from Ian Savonius, who says, I didn't even know this was still a band.
That kind of hurt.
Sorry.
Yeah,
I'm just reporting.
I know.
I don't know why I brought that up.
No, just, that's the thing, is leave it all in.
No, but I mean, this is someone that you've developed. Anyway, that's not the point. The point is, it seems like a lot of legwork that you had to do. Can you talk about the experience of making this book? And do you know, actually, off the top of your head, how many voices are in this book?
No, I mean, I have maybe 70.
It's like 73, I think.
73?
You think 73?
73, 74.
Maybe 73. I don't know. Maybe.
I counted.
We have an over-under.
Then we had some last-minute ads.
I mean, there are sort of two groups of interviewees. Like, there's people who are intimately involved with the band and helped, you know, helped them along the way. Like, bands like the New Bomb Turks, with whom they shared, like, a serious friendship and were instrumental in getting them to a certain level. And then there's a lot of bands, you know, because these guys tour festivals, who they just run into backstage and have a good hang and they have a good anecdote. So, you know, those kinds of interviews can be done by email. Generally, you're looking for a very specific piece of information. Whereas people who've kind of played a more instrumental role in the band, you know, require a much more in-depth conversation to, you know, chart their progress. But, yeah, I mean, it's everything from in-person to phoners to Skype to emails.
Can you maybe talk about some of the more notable people and maybe even a memorable story about interviewing any of them?
Well, the most popular name on a massive level would be Elijah Wood and Ralph Macchio, who appeared in the video trilogy for their last record, Below the Belt. Those people I actually did not get to talk to directly because they are famous Hollywood celebrities with people surrounding them, but I was able to, through a third party, relay my questions to them, and actually the guys who directed the videos, the Diamond Brothers, you know, filmed them answering the questions for me, so
you got video of them.
I have video evidence of them, at least, I didn't get to meet them, but I know they at least heard questions
and are talking to you
and responded to them.
It was like a big thrill for you that day.
It was.
See those answers coming back.
But what's great, what really amazed me, not that it should surprise me, but you know, people love this band. It's not just like, yeah, they're a cool band, I saw them once, but like, you know, someone like John Garcia from Caius, who's, you know, Caius were one of the great stoner rock bands of the 90s, and Spawn, Queens of the Stone Age, among other bands. You know, this is a guy who's like a veteran, has been doing this for 20, 25 years. And, you know, the intensity with which he was telling me his story about first hearing Danko Jones, it was like, you know, it was like he'd seen God. And this was a guy who's like been through the ringer, has every reason to be dejected and sort of cynical about the music industry, and you know, he heard this band and it sort of invigorated his love of music. Someone like Hank from Turbo Negro, who, you know, a band very notorious for their partying ways, you know, looked to Danko, who, you know, notice he's not holding a beer, it's not something he does. Very much, and you know, so to have Hank, who's like one of the most notorious partiers in Scandinavia, basically credit Danko with turning him sober was a really amazing revelation.
Is that, I don't even remember, really, did that happen?
You should read the book, Vish.
Every third chunk of interview is just like, Danko Jones is the best band ever. Everyone says that. It's remarkable. Are you surprised by how much love you got from some of these people? That some of them are your peers, some of them are your heroes?
Well, it was flattering.
That's it there. That was the whole reason for writing this book.
That book could have been a lot shorter, I think, if maybe you were answering most of the questions. Danko, going back a ways, you used to do something kind of weird. You made prank calls.
Yes, I did.
This amused me to no end, just reading
it. I used to do it before the Jerky Boys, so if people, for a lot of people, like, Jerky Boys...
It's all about credibility for you, isn't it? You just need to establish the fact that you were there first. You're the Christopher Columbus of prank calls.
No, I wasn't. I was inspired by a record called Great Phone Calls.
Yeah.
If anybody knows that, that had like Neil Hamburger calling up for the first time. That was the first time I ever heard the name Neil Hamburger.
Mm-hmm.
And he sounded different. I think he sounded more like his real offstage persona, trying to get a gig at a comedy night. That record was, it still is the funniest prank call record I've ever heard in my life.
Right.
Just For a Laugh is good too, but the Great Phone Calls is the best.
So, to give people an example of one of these prank calls, is there...
Yeah.
When did you make these?
I made them in 93.
1993?
Yeah. So, Vish and Stuart, when we had a conference call for this book launch, they both wanted me to play an old prank call. I've never digitized it, so I had to go into the basement and dig up a box, and I found, I have two left, and I found, I've got one here, and I released it, and I sold it out of Rotate This and the Record Peddler.
Can we hear? Can we just hear?
Yeah, I'll do, yeah.
Right.
The thing is, it rested on whether one of us or any of us had a cassette player, and Vish got one. So here it is. I put it in. I queued it up before we started here, so it's all queued up.
Put the mic in.
Sorry, I should preface this with, I call up an auctioneer looking for a job. This is in 93. I'm just trying to get credit.
No, it's good.
Who are you? Let me introduce myself. My name is Pete Lee. I work auctioneer on the street lock down in the Middle East here. 55, 65, 75, 59, 95, 105, sold to where you're at. What do you think about that?
Pete, what is your name?
Pete Lee, here. And where are you calling from? Calling from my home here, on the ranch. I'm looking forward at work.
Where's your ranch?
My ranch. It's up in Muskoka.
Okay, how much is that number? I'm on the other line, so I'll call you back. You sure have a number?
44, 44, 44, 44, 44.
I know that. Give me your code number. Okay. 49122. 491. That's right. 2. Keep going. 491222. Right on. 51122. 45.
So that's it. Thanks. I didn't really hear that since I put it out in 93. So I was laughing earlier tonight.
That's amazing. That is really funny. So these are
some pretty authentic Nebraska.
Hey, can we get Pete Lee here?
The Skokie.
Is Pete Lee here?
Pete Lee is not here. He is not around anymore. And that all that stuff I did at the Eaton Center, I used to work at Music World. And yeah, I'd show up. If I had a shift that started at 4, I would show up at 3:30 and I would make phone calls for like half an hour and then I'd go to work.
So. Do you still think of yourself as something of a troublemaker?
No, not at all. Absolutely not.
You don't do this kind of thing anymore?
Absolutely not.
What about the feuds? There's feuds mentioned in the book. You had a feud with Chaos.
You're bringing this shit up, aren't you? Chaos was supposed to be in the book.
Happening.
Yeah. Chaos was supposed to be in the book.
He respectfully declined.
Right. So you start. I'm just saying, you still start problems. You are a bit of a troublemaker.
No. You were trying to get in touch with Gogo Bordello. We did a tour of them in 06 for like 4 excruciating weeks with that band.
And you don't like that band.
Well, I got no opinion.
How is that even possible for you, Danko Jones, to have no opinion?
Hey, look, it took him 9 days to say hi to me. Every day. First day.
Be straight up. You didn't like
it? Yeah, I'm going to be straight up. First day of the tour, you all want to be friends. There's like 3-4 bands on the tour, on the package. It was like a Vans thing. It's like, hey. Bedouin Soundclash were there too. So the Gogo Bordello, the dude, Eugene, what's his last name? Hutz, walks by me. I go, hey man, that walks right by me. First day, I'm like, oh, he's probably in the zone. Let's give him day two. Day two, same thing. By day 7, I was just like, no, this guy's an asshole. That's it. And he was for the whole tour.
The irony is that he's good friends with Elijah Wood.
Oh, really?
He's a friend of Danko Jones. Eugene and Elijah starred in the film Everything is Illuminated together. So I was hoping we could work some Elijah magic to get Eugene in the book,
but the quote you have from Eugene in the book is him disparagingly introducing Danko Jones, who were on after them?
Yeah, Danko told me the story of how they were on before Gogo Bordello and, Gogo Bordello were on before Danko.
Get that right, Stuart.
Yes, sir. And, Eugene said, coming up next is an AC/DC cover band. And I was able to find evidence. I found some reviews online that quoted that.
But the best part was for the rest of the tour, before they went on stage, we played AC/DC really, really loud.
What song?
No, we just kept playing AC/DC before. Yeah.
Our sound man Corey's in the crowd. He would crank up every time Eugene would say something on stage about us, and it was usually referencing AC/DC, he would crank up, what was it, Highway to Hell? Like, the moment they turned off their instruments, he would start the PA at, like, double the sound.
That's awesome.
So,
all right, listen, we should wrap this up in some way, but I do want to ask you finally about what you hope people get out of this book, because there's just a lot of threads in here. It's not simply a profile or a biography of a band. It really talks a lot about Toronto community, how it's grown, how you've grown sort of out of it and done well overseas. It's a lot about respect. It's a lot about just making dreams come true, if I might say.
I do want to mention that in the book, there's a few people in the crowd here who are in the book. I just want to just say that, there's Canning B, at Canning B is there, Brendan Canning.
Hey, Brendan. Hi, buddy.
listen to.
Brendan says he had to be here by
contract. 29. If you hear the last podcast we did, Brendan just steals the show, and you got to hear it because he's hilarious. And then there's our sound man Corey, who's there.
Are you here with Al Pacino's daughter, Brendan? Okay. That's part of the podcast. Sorry, inside jokes are never funny.
Craig Daniels from the Leather Uppers is here. Dick Switzer is here. Al Nolan is here. Bruce LaBruce is here.
Wow.
I don't know if I'm forgetting anybody,
Melissa Grant is here.
Who?
Who? Melissa Grant.
Melissa Grant is here.
Well, I'm glad that Melissa's here. Thanks, Melissa, for coming down. But she's not in the book. This is why I'm just pointing out the people who are in the book who are in the crowd. So
right.
Thanks to all of those that I mentioned that are here in the crowd as well.
It was an interesting response to my question.
I know. I had to get it out. I'm sorry.
Stuart, 2 minutes to respond. Okay. Anyway, listen. I just want to give people who have been sitting here patiently. Are you guys having a good time during all of this, by the way?
I try to throw some dirt just to interest
people. We wanted to thank
Gogo Bordello.
We want to thank
it.
Yeah. Sorry. A lot of these people. Anyway, we want to wrap this up, but just as a last remark, Stuart, what do you want to say to people who are picking up this book?
I was just hoping people get a renewed appreciation for a band, perhaps that they might take for granted, and get a real sense of what this band has accomplished without a lot of the traditional tools that bands have to catapult them to success. And it's not as tragic as the Anvil story per se, but I do see some parallels in the sense of a band that's underappreciated in their hometown, but also have a lot of admirers, a lot of celebrity admirers, a lot of people in sort of exalted positions who are big fans of this band, and take a step back and ask yourself, why does this band get so much love elsewhere but not in their hometown?
Do you have any final thoughts on that particular problem? Like, why is it that Lemmy from Motorhead will love Danko Jones? I go to see Jello Biafra at Lee's Palace. Who shows up on stage? Danko Jones. Shows up without the lyrics to the song he's supposed to sing. But still, he's there. Jello brings him out. Quite a remarkable sight. So there's all these people that have accomplished Guns N' Roses. These aren't small names. These are people getting behind Danko Jones. Some people are saying they're one of the best bands ever.
And they're not just they're not just throwing them a bone. They're genuine.
It's
true
all very
fans
heartfelt. Yeah.
And very they have a very intense connection with their music.
Hmm.
I don't know. I think there's a lot of good quotes in the book if you read it about theories about why things happen for them elsewhere but not here. I think it's changes in the way radio, the consolidation of radio ownership, in the early 2000s sort of affected Danko Jones's place in the sort of media landscape here. I think in general, things are a little more trend-driven here, and that, in Europe there might be more of an appreciation for, there's more, long-term kind of fandom among music fans there, that they're not so beholden to the latest trends. It's not such a chew 'em up and spit 'em out kind of culture, that people are real die-hard True Blue fans for life. So, maybe it's just, the book is just sort of a request to, take a step back and appreciate, what you have here. And,
yeah.
Don't send all of our great bands overseas and to get recognition.
Right. That was very well put, everybody? JC and Danko, before we go, your perception of this book, you've both read the thing by now, I assume. How does it feel to see your whole lives, your professional lives, kind of unfold in a book? I know you put Stuart up to writing the book, so it's
great.
Kind of,
yeah, it feels great.
It feels great. Flattering. And even. JC, what about you?
I think it's going to give people a chance who don't know the band to get caught up with the band. And this year, with having the book come out and the new CD and the DVD, it's just kind of almost like playing catch up on the band for all these years that we've done. And I think it's going to be great for people to read.
The new album is Rock and Roll is Black and Blue, coming out.
Yeah,
comes out October 9th.
Yeah.
I can do all the plugging. I know what's going on.
Sorry.
So everyone can pick that up. And ladies and gentlemen, how about a big round of applause for our panel, Stuart Berman, Danko Jones, and JC. Thanks for coming.